You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an outdoor recreation program called the Canoe Mobile is in Milwaukee this week. We'll learn more about the ways it's connecting urban children to nature. Now, the FBI searched Mar-a-Lago last week. They had a warrant to search the Florida home of former President Trump for a trove of classified documents that belong to the National Archives. The list of documents taken under that warrant, which is made public by Attorney General Merrick Garland, included four sets of top secret documents and seven other sets of information at different levels of classification. We're talking about the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago, laws about classified information and presidential record keeping, and the ways that search warrants are issued and executed. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago? What do you want to know that you don't know now? Do you have questions about how these kind of searches might be authorized and undertaken? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Cammie Chavis is a professor of law and director of the Center for Criminal Justice Policy and Reform at William & Mary Law School. She's also a former federal prosecutor. Cammie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with some nuts and bolts here. What needs to happen in order for law enforcement to get this kind of search warrant in the first place?
Yes. So what I think is really interesting is, you know, a lot of people want to make distinctions. This is a former president and these are classified documents. But the FBI is a federal law enforcement agency, and there are rules that govern all types of all kinds of searches. And so there are three laws that the search warrant has implicated. But what we know is that you have to have probable cause that a crime has been committed and that there's a reasonable likelihood that evidence of that crime will be found in the particular space specified by the warrant. This comes directly from our Constitution that you cannot issue a warrant without probable cause. So that tells us a lot about the information that would have been contained within the affidavit for the judge to sign off on this warrant.
Now, what we have in terms of rock solid information here is that warrant that's been released and the list of material removed, vague in some cases, but with some indications of the kind of classification levels of the documents removed. From what you see there, what do you think of that initial case that there was probable cause here? It seems like the FBI went in and found what the warrant said they were looking for.
Yes. And again, there have been a number of news media outlets, Associated Press and others, that are asking the court to unseal the underlying affidavit. So what was easily made public, Merrick Garland released the information, so we know the kinds of documents that were retrieved. But what we don't know right now is the information that led up to that. That is under the court has sealed that information, and DOJ at present has opposed, and it makes sense that they would oppose unsealing that affidavit. They've said, and this is a quote: "This is a roadmap to their investigation." And it would be really, in any circumstance, unusual to unseal that affidavit. There's, again, giving information about witnesses and other evidence that the government may have that might jeopardize the investigation before things actually progress.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that affidavit. So this is the material the FBI goes to. I think it's called a magistrate judge says, here's the information we have that says we have probable cause to go do this. This is why we want you to issue this warrant. Is this something that material is ever released in the midst of an investigation?
It's, as I said, it would be highly unusual for it to be released. Of course, if let's say in this case, if any defendant, if Donald Trump were to become a defendant and then had to and was charged or indicted with these particular crimes and there was a trial, there would be discovery in that, and the defendant would certainly be privy to information there. But right now, it's early in the investigation. And again, you're trying to get these documents to even to see if you even have a crime that's been committed.
Now, this we've been talking sort of generically about search warrants. Now, this is a former president of the United States. Arguments from media organizations wanting this affidavit unsealed have said this is a big deal. This is an unusual circumstance where a former president is being investigated. Some Republican members of Congress have said this, too, including two from Wisconsin. We should unseal that affidavit because we really want to make sure that a current administration isn't unfairly targeting a previous administration. Do you think there's a case to be made that this is special and might work a little differently in this case?
Well, I think it's, of course, the Department of Justice would be concerned about jeopardizing this investigation or any other investigation. And while I'm certainly sympathetic to this absolutely is a case of great public interest, but there are also, I think, countervailing considerations. And to that, you know, again, if DOJ has the opportunity to present evidence to a grand jury and either someone is indicted or not, you know, that is the process that this would go through. And even again, there's quite a bit of secrecy related to grand jury. To the grand jury for similar reasons. We're worried about witness tampering, and we're worried about jeopardizing an investigation. I think that it's fair. Of course, the public wants to know. I think it's also a very sad moment in our history where we really don't trust on a lot of people on kind of either side of the political spectrum don't trust whatever processes are in place, but these laws and the processes are in place for a reason, and that's to preserve the integrity of the institution and of our criminal justice system.
Talking to Cami Chavis, law professor, director of the Center for Criminal Justice Policy and Reform at William & Mary Law School, also former federal prosecutor, looking at the FBI executing a search warrant last week at Mar-a-Lago, former President Trump's home in Florida. You can join in with your thoughts or maybe your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Greg is with us in Madison. Greg, hello.
Hi. So my comment or question is, what could he possibly do with documents of this sort? And that would maybe lead to an answer as to why he had them. You know, the idea that he's home working late at night just doesn't really fly. His version of work was watching TV and tweeting. So I wonder what he really wanted to do with these documents.
Greg, thanks for the question. Cami, I assume that's part of the question in this investigation. A, what did he have? Why did he have it? What was he going to do with it? Do you have some thoughts on what that investigation would look like?
Yeah. Well, you know, at this point, all the information that we have, and we have quite a bit in terms of thinking about the three crimes or the three federal laws that were implicated, one of them being the Presidential Records Act and the other being the Espionage Act. So if I am a prosecutor and I'm looking at those laws, what we're thinking about is not whether necessarily what the president may have intended to do with those, that there may be other federal laws and other evidence that would establish a crime. But simply retaining under the Presidential Records Act, simply retaining those documents and not giving them to the National Archives, the federal law that makes that a crime. This is, you know, for the first couple hundred years of our country, presidents were able to take their documents home. But when Richard Nixon decided, so after they were not in office anymore, they were ready to pack up their things, they could go to their home. But President Nixon had some thoughts about what he wanted to do and just destroying certain evidence. And so this law was passed in 1978 in part in response to that. So again, if we're looking at the letter of that, you know, of that statute, because I think there are a lot of crimes that people, a lot of bad things that people may think that Donald Trump was doing with this, but really simply by not giving the records over to the National Archives when they've requested them, that is the criminal act there. And then the Espionage Act, it's very important that we safeguard documents with that are top secret, and some of the ones classified here, top secret, compartmented, things that could be, and the language is, if uncovered and made public, could be exceptionally grave. That's the language, exceptionally grave consequences for U.S. interests. We want to deter people from doing that. We want to encourage people to treat those documents in a certain manner. And so that's why that law exists. And that's the other law that's one of the other laws that has been mentioned. So we can think about all the interesting things that someone might do with those documents, but he hasn't been accused of that, that we know.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about the FBI search and seizure of a variety of documents, including some classified material at Mar-a-Lago. Cammie Chavis is with us, professor of law, director of the Center for Criminal Justice and Policy and Reform at William & Mary Law School, former federal prosecutor. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this search? What do we not know that you want to know? What do you think of this idea that some media organizations are promoting and some Republicans in Congress that the affidavit, the material that led to the issuing of the search warrant, should also be revealed to the public? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago and rules about search warrants and classified documents with former prosecutor Cammie Chavis, now a professor of law, director of the Center for Criminal Justice, Policy and Reform at William & Mary Law School. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. Let's go back to your calls now. Jacob is with us in Madison. Jacob, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just a little bit astounded as to how he actually was successful in arranging to get boxes and boxes and boxes of documents shipped to Mar-a-Lago when nobody was aware of this. Who else participated in helping him get this stuff shipped? He's a con artist. He's got a good part of the American public conned, and I just don't. I don't understand or accept this kind of behavior from a former president who is now a private citizen.
Jacob, thanks for the call. Cammie, what do you think?
You know, I think that the caller brings up a really good point. I always, especially tell my students, as somebody who's been, he has not yet been accused of a crime. We just have the search warrant, right? And there's just this information. But if he ends up being indicted for these crimes, I doubt seriously that it would just be the president alone, because of course, with other crimes, you have to have, an accomplice, right? Sometimes in order to make sure that this all goes according to plan. So I think that Jacob is right, that there could be multiple people, and they have to be pretty high level people who, in my opinion, should have known better. And again, even if the documents were correctly shipped to the president to have him review while he's at Mar-a-Lago, then why weren't they returned? That is a question. And there should be very specific protocols when we're talking about the certain levels of documents that we are talking about, protocols for sending them out, receiving them back in, controls as to who is able to see them and who is not. And so somewhere along the way, it really does seem, if true, that some of those protocols have been breached. So I think that we would be not only looking at the individuals who could be accomplices in this, but we really need to investigate, as Jacob said, how did this happen in the first place?
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Kurt joins us now in Milton. Kurt, hi.
Hello to you.
What did you want to bring up, Kurt?
Well, I'm a retired military officer with over 30 years in the defense community and military, handling way above top secret level information. And we do that in a facility called a SCIF, a Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility. And there are strict rules and things for that. But I had, in the handling of it and all of those things. But I had heard that there was a SCIF in Mar-a-Lago. And, that kind of changes everything if it was an approved facility to have very beyond top secret information. The other thing I'd like to know is, in the handling of it and all of that would be all taken care of through proper channels if he indeed had a SCIF. So I'd like to know if that's the case. And I'd also like to know, do they have classified material or SCIFs at other presidential libraries?
Kurt, thanks for the call. My understanding, I read up on this a little, Cammy, my understanding was there was a SCIF in Mar-a-Lago during the Trump presidency. It is now no longer considered an active SCIF facility for that at this point now. But Kurt sees, if it's handled properly, says it's maybe a game changer. What do you think?
Yes, I mean, I think that's true. And as I said earlier, if if that is where the president was spending a lot of time and needed to have access to documents, that would make sense. But there would be protocols. What's interesting here, particularly when we look at the Espionage Act and the Presidential Records Act, it seems to relate not to things that were happening during his presidency, but the fact that the National Archives requested these documents after he was no longer president, and again, and indeed received, I think, something like 15 boxes back in January. And there seemed to be an incomplete transferal back to the National Archives. So I think that is where if there's criminal liability, where that would come in.
Thanks for that call, Kurt. We'll go now to Danny with us in Beloit. Danny, hello.
Hello. Yes, I had a question. I was wondering if with the DOJ or the FBI, when they took an inventory and they carried everything out of the house, if Trump's attorneys wasn't available to be able to document everything, doesn't it open a Pandora's box to where pretty much anything could be stated that was in there?
Danny, thanks for the call. That's interesting, Kevin. Usually when a search warrant is executed, does the person receiving the search or their legal representation usually get to tag along and observe what's being removed?
No. And I think that, again, what I think is so interesting about this search, we're talking about potentially, as I mentioned, information that could be exceptionally grave, have exceptionally grave consequences to U.S. interests, right? There are every day in this country search warrants that are executed. We're all very familiar with the no-knock warrants and certain types of drug raids and things like that. People do not get to tag along, and usually you are asked to kind of step aside. What you do get, and what the law does say that you should get, and that is a receipt for things that were taken out of the office. Out of the area to be searched. And so I think that if we take some of the arguments that we're hearing, and I've always been, I am a critic of government overreach in certain types of criminal activity, but it's really interesting that we don't hear those same arguments when we're talking about low-level other types of crime. Drug crimes is one thing I'm thinking about. This warrant, this situation was there was lots of notice. We know that the National Archives was looking for this information. We know they requested it multiple times. And we know that that their agents came to the house with a search warrant. And they did knock and announce themselves, and they went through the search process. So again, I think that the criticisms that are being levied against this are valid. There's a lot of distrust in many communities about law enforcement. But if we are to believe that the FBI would have planted these documents, then do we believe that every single person who's arrested for drugs or other type of contraband that law enforcement is planting it there? I just the equivalency. I think is really interesting here. Argument. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Danny. Time for one more quick call with Brent in Waukesha. Brent, hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My question is kind of along the same lines. As far as, you know, with a search warrant, I always thought that it was, you know, to prove a crime has been committed, not to search for a possible crime that, you know, you're searching for the crime, but you're proving that it's already happened. And in this case, we've said many times the crime hasn't happened yet. We're just trying to see if it did happen.
Gotcha. Brent, thanks for the call. That brings us back to where we started and this concept of probable cause, Cammie. And in fact, that doesn't mean a crime has been committed. It means there's a probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's right. There's probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed and that evidence of that crime can be found at the location, reasonably likely to be found at the location to be searched. And I think it's very important here because when we're talking about what crime, we're not talking about whether this person has given government secrets away. That's not what the Presidential Records Act says, and that's not what the espionage says. Both of those acts are really talking about how evidence is handled. You are not supposed to conceal. That is language from the Presidential Records Act. Conceal or destroy presidential records, things that were created by the president in his duties, in his formal duties as president, or by his staff.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Cammie Chavis from William & Mary Law School. She joined us for a look at classified document laws and the process of search warrants in the wake of the FBI's search of former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago home last week. The Canoe-mobile is in Milwaukee this week. It's not a giant canoe with an engine and wheels. It's a fleet of vans carrying 6 10-person canoes along with outdoor equipment, educational materials, and teachers. The program is put on by a nonprofit group called Wilderness Inquiry, and they're out on Lake Michigan to give kids a free learning experience out in nature and on the water. Tonight, they're out on Lakeshore State Park until 7 p.m. On Friday, they'll be at the Jackson Park Pond from 4 to 7. Willie Tully is the Development Director for Wilderness Inquiry. Willie, welcome to Central Time.
Rob, thank you. So happy to be here.
How does the Canoe-mobile program work?
Yeah, so in the physical sense, Wilderness Inquiry's Canoe-mobile is a van and a trailer and 6 canoes, as you said, and 7 of our trained outdoor leaders who fan out across the country. We send our Canoe-mobile rigs coast to coast, and we're in Milwaukee this week. And we work with national partners and local partners to connect kids and families to educational and recreational programming on local waterways. So this week, we're bringing kids from Milwaukee out to Lakeshore State Park and Jackson Park and Lincoln Park as well to learn and paddle and explore with us and mostly to have some fun.
And that's the what. How about the why?
Yeah. So, you know, connections to the outdoors, especially the last couple of years, have been shown to be as important as ever. Bringing people together in the outdoors, strengthening community, but also You know, the outdoors provide so many mental and physical health benefits, support the academic well-being of students, as well as social emotional development. And so for us, it's really about, you know, how can we bring kids together? How can we connect them to supportive adults through recreational activities that include canoeing and exploring in local parks? So it really is a way that we can invest in the healthy development of kids and families.
I know some of the target audience here is going to be kids who have maybe never been out on a boat. Can you talk about the sort of the boot camp to get them ready and out on the water?
Absolutely. So 80% of the kids that join us to paddle have never been in a canoe. So this is a first time experience. It can be a little bit of a scary experience. Our staff are highly trained and safety is our number one priority. So we have all of the supportive equipment needed. Our 20-foot, 4-foot, 10-person canoes are almost untippable. We bring these big boats out.
I'd find a way, I bet. I'm not great at it.
It's a challenge. But you know, for us, it's, you know, these, the kids go out maybe a little bit tentative and, but we really work, we support them. We, take them out. And then when they get back to land, they have big smiles and, you know, lots of high fives.
What are you hoping happens after you visit a city, say Milwaukee in this instance? What are you hoping goes on with the kids who participate and the groups you work with in the community?
That's such an awesome question. Yeah, Canoemobile is our program, our introductory program that we hope plants the seed for future engagement. So we also, Wilderness Inquiry has a number of programs that then builds from that initial experience. Overnight trips to local parks or extended trips to national forests and national parks. We have a base camp up in the Apostle Islands. And so we bring groups from the Milwaukee area up there to deepen that engagement and experience. And you know, that model follows what we call our pyramid of engagement that is really about how can we invest in healthy development of kids, but then also, you know, build lifelong lovers and users of our outdoor places.
Who are the partners you're working with on this Wisconsin trip?
Yeah, so we work with both local and federal partners. So some of our funders for this, so the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service. We're also working with Wisconsin DNR, Lakeshore State Park, River Edge Nature Center, Milwaukee River Keepers, as well as a number of schools and youth-serving organizations as well that help connect us to kids and families.
Now, of course, you can't make it to every community. Can you leave us with some thoughts for people, wherever they might be, to try to find opportunities like this to connect kids with the outdoors?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, for those that want to follow along with the Canoemobile, you can go to canoemobile.org and check us out. But, you know, for us, the outdoors can be right in your backyard. We have parks, we have waterways, we have trails, and it doesn't need to mean going miles and miles from home. You can engage in nature right in your own backyard, and that's really a great starting point. And so many of the benefits that have been shown to derive from engagement in nature can happen in your backyard or can happen on an adventure a little bit further afield. So we really encourage everyone to get outside.
Willie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
That's Willie Tully, Development Director for Wilderness Inquiry, with us today to share more about an outdoor education program. It's visiting Milwaukee and Lake Michigan this week called Canoemobile. They'll be at Lakeshore Park tonight until 7 p.m., and they'll be at the Jackson Park Pond on Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. Outside for Wisconsin Life, here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about an Army Reserve veteran who now lives in Shawano County.
Joanne Shedler's family was fighting in wars long before the U.S. military existed. This is one reason the nurse joined the Army Reserve later in life and eventually co-founded the Mohican Veterans Group. Shedler lives in Gresham and shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative.
I was an older nursing student that went to Marquette University in Milwaukee. And after I graduated with my Bachelor's of Science in Nursing, a family member who is an Army recruiter talked to me and said that I could get a direct commission in the Army if I wanted to join it. I thought that was a great opportunity because of the history of my family. As a Native American, we have fought in wars since before the military, U.S. military. I was commissioned as a second lieutenant, which is the bottom ranks of officers. Our reserve unit got called to active duty. We started out at Fort McCoy, in Wisconsin. We were in big barracks, and it was very dreary. And so we got a little opportunity to run into Walmart, and I bought some things to help decorate up our bathroom. The other women really appreciated that. I also am a beautician, which I did before I became a nurse, and I offered free haircuts to people because we were there after 4 months, and there was only a barber at the on the base. And to me, that helped with our morale. And as a leader, I think it showed that you can make the best of whatever situation you're in. I also got a tribal flag that I brought along, and I hung it outside when I got to have a little area where I did have some privacy. And that was kind of cool because it gave a lot of people an understanding that there's Native Americans that are also here. We're a whole variety of people. Parts of our unit were pulled and called up to go to Afghanistan. I volunteered to do that, but by this time I had received my promotion to major. They were looking for ICU nurses, and I was a med surg and administrator at that time. So I did not get the chance to do that, but we stayed on a few more months. And then 2004, I retired after 20 years and 6 months in the Army Reserves. So when I was back home, I became a tribal council person, a legislator for my tribe. As a veteran, I was very interested in our history. So I was a part of our historical society for our tribe. Myself and two other tribal member women who were retired Army, we started the Mohegan Veterans about 17 years ago. And so we have our own Mohegan Veterans organization. We're formed because we want to recognize and be at all the funerals as honor guards. And we have an Eagle Staff, which is a memorial Eagle Staff that we've started. And my Eagle Feather, one of my Eagle Feathers that I have, when I pass on, my family can give it to our veterans. And then at my funeral, they will tie that Eagle Feather onto the staff. Our veterans group were instrumental also in putting together a veterans memorial. And in front of our clinic, we have a memorial now. And so every day we can see that there with many names that are there. So we continue to honor our veterans many ways.
That was Joanne Shedler of Gresham, Wisconsin. She shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, if you're in school, say, or you're starting your career or thinking of changing careers, someone maybe, probably has told you at some point to follow your passion or just do what you love. Our next guest is a sociologist who, after years of telling others to follow their passions, started to feel like that advice didn't sound quite right. Aaron Seck is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Michigan and author of the book The Trouble with Passion, How Searching for Fulfillment at Work Fosters Inequality. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you, as I mentioned, once dispensed this advice yourself. A lot of people have over the years. Where did this idea come from that if you're looking for work, follow your passion?
Sure. Well, it's been around for a long time. We've seen that that is an idea that people have held on to in their understanding of what good work means since at least the late 1970s, early 1980s, and has really only increased in power as we've seen people look at the labor force and say, you know what, it's not the kind of stable place that maybe my parents or my grandparents' generation had access to. Maybe I better find work that I love.
And where does that idea start to go wrong as you see it?
Right. So, I mean, we definitely don't want people being in jobs that they hate, that they want to make them want to tear their hair out on a regular basis. But the difficulty comes in two different places. One is who has access to jobs that are both aligned with their passion and also provide a decent income and are relatively stable. And what I find in my research is that the folks who can get jobs that are aligned with their passion and are stable and well-paying tend to be those who come from more well-off backgrounds in terms of socioeconomics. And they tend to have access to things that I call safety nets and springboards from their parents. Things like the ability to not have a whole lot of student loan debt, or social connections they might have in an industry to get them jobs from the very beginning after graduating college. And so telling everybody that they should follow their passion can actually help to reproduce a lot of the kinds of socioeconomic inequalities we see that students enter college with. The second part of the difficulty is, what does it mean that we are willing to show up for a job and maybe willing to sacrifice good pay or control over our hours or working 80 or 90 hours a week because we're doing work that we love? And one of the things I find is that people are willing to sacrifice a whole lot for jobs that they have some kind of personal connection to. But on the flip side of that, employers not only like people who are passionate about their work, but often will explicitly exploit that, try to find people that will be passionate about their work because they believe they won't have to pay them as much.
Yeah, let's follow up on that point. There have been exposés about things like the video game industry lately, Hollywood special effects companies, where people come in with a passion to do those things. Can you talk about how that plays out when employers might want to exploit that passion?
Absolutely. So that can happen in a couple of ways. One is exploiting the expectation that people will take on additional responsibilities and burdens without asking for much in return. And if an employer has people who are really passionate about their work, it means that they might not have to deal with that kind of pushback or requesting of additional resources or more control over their schedule. But then it also means that people, when they're trying to figure out how to navigate the requests for additional resources, can sometimes get stymied. So for example, a few years ago when we saw a streak of teacher strikes, one of the things that was pushing back against the claims that teachers were making for the need for more support and more pay was that people would say to teachers, well, you chose teaching because you're passionate about it. And so therefore you shouldn't want or need to ask for more money. So it takes away the kind of negotiation power that people have. Even if they're passionate about their work, they should still be able to ask for things like raises.
So for an individual in this situation, they've got a job, they felt passionate about coming into it, they realize they're, you know, overworked, they're hustling all the time, not really getting compensated. Now, if that person came to you and sought out job advice, what kind of things might you point them toward?
That's a really good question. So first and foremost, I would say to them, make sure that you are finding space in your life for things outside of your work that you're passionate about. The paid labor force was not designed to support us in our search for self-fulfillment and self-expression, right? It's structured to be able to advance the needs and the goals of the people who sort of own the businesses that we work for or run the organizations that we work for. And so we have to make sure to protect ourselves and our sense of identity and meaning in the instance that our job goes away or we get reassigned or even fired. And so one of the most important things is, how can we find things that we love that are completely unattached to the work that we do? And for people who are busy professionals, it actually takes work to find time outside of work for things that you're in, that inspire you and that you're excited about. But that's a really important piece to have a more holistic sense of personal identity that's outside of one's paid work. Another task is, how can we shrink the footprint of work in our lives? And that can be on the basis of how many hours per week we're working, or even how often we're on. We're checking our smartphones, we're checking our Slack channels for communication from our coworkers. How can we make room in our lives for just ourselves outside of the context of work? And the final thing I'll say is, we have to make sure that we don't inadvertently pressure the young people in our lives, or the people who are making decisions about their own career paths, to say to them that the best way and really the only way to make a career decision is to follow your passion and find work that you love. There's all kinds of ways in our lives to have work that we enjoy, that we don't hate going into work for. That can mean having colleagues that we like to work with. That can be liking the organization that we work for, even if we're not necessarily totally passionate about the particular tasks we do in our job. And another way is to have a job where we have pretty predictable hours and that we can confine the footprint of that work in a kind of confined space. And so the people in our lives that are trying to make that decision, make sure that we approach their decision making from a more holistic way rather than a passion is the only way kind of approach.
Talking to Aaron Sachs, sociologist at the University of Michigan, author of the book The Trouble with Passion: How Searching for Fulfillment at Work Fosters Inequality. Aaron, I want to go back to the first point now, the inequality thing. I can imagine, like, there's a lot of jobs out there where you either have to expect to make no money for a long time, maybe in the arts before you make it, or you are expected to do unpaid internships. I think media is a big one on that. Do you see structural fixes on that to make sure that people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds have a shot at that kind of thing?
Yes, some of that comes down to what academic institutions themselves are doing. One of the biggest burdens that students are facing when they leave college, of course, is student loan debt. And so not having such an intense burden of student loan debt can certainly help students from low-income families or who are first generation to even the playing field. Another thing is that schools can either pressure organizations to provide paid internships for those students the organizations that want to recruit students to work for them, or in absence of that, provide fellowships or scholarships for students who want to intern at a place that is beneficial for them career wise, but they might otherwise need to be able to work a job that would pay something to be able to help pay their bills and pay tuition and pay for books down the line. And then more broadly, encouraging both students and those in the communities to understand that the reason that people are interested in finding jobs they're passionate about to begin with is because the labor force is really precarious, and because we're expected to work for so many hours, most professionals are. And so thinking and promoting collective solutions that not only help the experiences of those who might be passionate about their work, but also the experiences of people who work in jobs that hold little ability for people being passionate about their work can help lift all boats, as the saying goes.
All right. A 1 minute drill here, Aaron. Suppose you're talking to a high school senior incoming this year. Leave them with a message as they look ahead to the job world.
Make sure to, as I say in my book, diversify your meaning-making portfolio, that the role that you have in your job is only one aspect of who you are as a person and should be only one place where you're nurturing a sense of self-expression and identity.
Aaron, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Aaron Sachs is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Michigan. She talked to us about her book. It's called The Trouble with Passion: How Searching for Fulfillment at Work Fosters Inequality. Interested in hearing from you. Did you follow your passion at some point in your career? How did it work out? Was it a good idea or a mistake? Did you ever have a job where You loved the idea of it coming in, but realized you were just overworked and undercompensated with the expectation that, hey, you love it. So take what you get. You can let us know. Share your story. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. And do you give this advice to young people yourself? Follow your passion. Yes or no? Email ideas@WPR.org.